Thank you to all who have read. We're going to do this a little different, too. We have a wonderful speaker who has many ties to Ridgeview. Some are a little more significant than others. But I'm going to let somebody who is significant in her life introduce her.
Carrie. It's me again. It's me again. I'm sorry. Thank you. This is what 28 looks like. Thank you. I'm sorry I was talking so fast earlier. You guys are a little intimidating. Like she said, the lady who's going to speak tonight does have some significant ties to Ridgeview. She is engaged to Stanley, who's the most wonderful man, and he's an active member of Ridgeview Alumni. She's also my sponsor. And, there goes the crying. I'm not going to cry at all, but I learned by watching Sue. Sue doesn't give me a lot of demands, and if I ask for something, she gives it to me. If I ask for something, she sure gives it to me. The main thing that I've learned by watching Sue is you do things for people out of love, and you do things for people in the hopes that they'll do something nice for somebody else someday. You don't do things for people for stuff in return. You just do it because you love them, and you generally want to help them. And she's something else, and she's gonna be funny and serious and fun and wonderful. So get ready, buckle up. Here she comes.
Lord, I have no idea how I'm supposed to follow that. I'm Sue, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sue.
Can everybody hear me?
No.
I told you. Stan told me not to stand too close, but I always say people complain they can't hear me. Is that better?
No.
Lean in, baby.
Lean in. Uh-oh. It's his fault. Where's he at? Who knocked this off earlier? Okay. How's that? Is that better? I do have one question. Why the hell is everybody here? It was supposed to be last week, and I thought I was really going to luck out, and nobody would show up this week, and you're all here. I don't know why. I still am trying to figure out why I was asked to do this. You know, I'm just an average old alcoholic. My story is no different than anybody else's here. But here goes. War fever ran high in the New England town which we grew. I'm sorry. I just thought that would be a better story than mine. Bill's story just hits it all. But that was from my sponsee. Sorry. I swore to them I was going to tell Bill's story instead of mine. I grew up in Cedartown, Georgia, which is up in northwest Georgia. And I think it's a little bit unusual that I had, like, the most perfect childhood. I grew up on a dairy farm. I played out in the yard with the cows and the chickens, and my parents were great church-going people, and I had a brother and a sister and relatives galore. You know, and life was just really, really good. There's no but here. I didn't have a horrible childhood whatsoever. I just grew up, but, well, I guess there is a but. I always felt different, I can tell you that, from my first memory. I felt like I did not fit in. I never felt like I had a true friend in my life. As I look back at it now, obviously, I never let people be friends with me, but I moved around a couple of elementary schools, and I always blamed that just because of the fact we moved off the farm and to a different farm, et cetera, et cetera. And I felt like that's the reason why I didn't make any great long-term friends. But in reality, It's because I was already an alcoholic. I truly believe that. I grew up in a Southern Baptist environment, which usually gets a joke, a laugh. I don't know. And nobody in my family is a drinker. How about that? I have no history of it. However, if alcoholics don't drink, it's kind of hard to tell if they're an alcoholic. But I mean, it was absolutely teetotaling household, no booze whatsoever. Of my first experience of drinking was, as many of yours, something that I absolutely positively loved. I was probably around 15, and I'd had a job at a restaurant there called the Old Mill, and we had a Christmas party, and the guy who owned it, whose name was Scooter, he had all this free booze and champagne and everything, and I figured out that stuff was pretty good, and I liked the way it felt. And all I remember about the end of the evening is that I kept trying to go inside one side of the kitchen to get another bottle of booze while they kept trying to follow me around to get it out of my hands. And that's pretty much the rest of my story. You know, that's going to be a thread here. But that was one isolated event. I played basketball in high school. I was a fairly active person. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke until I left home to go to Athens. Ooh, a couple other Athens people here, I take it? And there I learned the joys of being able to drink without reserve and finding people around me that got drunk, and that looked like fun, and I decided that's what I needed to do, too. I can remember one time asking this lady who was to become my future mother-in-law, was I a bad drunk? And she said, no, you're a real quiet one. You just crawl under the table and go to sleep. That soon changed, too. But I was in Athens, and let me backtrack here a minute. I was talking about high school and the fact that I didn't really have any close friends. I had a lot of acquaintances, but not a lot of friends. And all the friends I had were guy friends. And I wanted to mention that because I guarantee you that a bunch of the women here in this room can understand that. It was something about the guy friends absolutely positively seemed accepting of me, whereas the girls, I just couldn't quite get the girl friendship down. I have to report that that's different now, but, you know, and then later on, I kind of figured out that maybe the guys had an ulterior motive, that they wanted to be my friend, but it took me a little while to figure that out. But I found that out in Athens, too. The time in Athens, I mean, I can't even describe to you, I thought that people that drank did so in excess. And, you know, part of me wants to point out and say, my childhood, I didn't have any exposure to drinking, so what else was I supposed to think? Well, I don't think it had a thing to do in my childhood. I think it, again, was because I'm an alcoholic. But I did it to excess every single time. I can't remember a time I drank without drinking to get drunk. That's what one did. I moved to Athens. I think I should start up a pattern of my alcoholic behaviors. I moved to Athens rather suddenly. Matter of fact, someone said, what are you doing this weekend? And I said, I don't have any plans. They said, you want to move to Athens? I said, sure. And off I went. That sort of thing kept happening in Athens in terms of where I was living, whether or not I was going to school at the time, things of that sort. And then one night I was out with my boss, who I'd been working for about 2 years, and he said, hey, you want to get married? And I said, sure. You know? I still haven't figured that one out. I know I was running from something. I just still haven't figured out what I was running from, or perhaps, really, I was running towards something. Because to me, that meant independence. It meant that I didn't have to report to my parents anymore. And this guy was a heavy drinker. Oh, yeah. It had all the makings of a lovely relationship. So we got married 1 month later, and we had never had a date or anything. Matter of fact, I had to go back and break up with this guy. In order to be officially engaged. So, and the guy was my soon-to-be husband's best friend, but that's neither here nor there, just a little bit more sick. Anyway, I can remember our first little place. We lived up in Chattanooga, and him coming home from work and me having the cocktails ready. Because that's what you did. You're a married couple, you have cocktails. And I remember one time, just one time, he suggested, maybe we shouldn't drink every day. And I was like, huh? And he never mentioned that again. So we, of course, hung around with a very much of a partying crowd. He was in the restaurant business. Oh, I didn't tell y'all, when I was in Athens, I became a bartender. I mean, how perfect is that? I was not only around the booze, but I was in control, and I was also the center of attention. So that was the absolute perfect job for me. But we decided that since I was now a married woman, that I shouldn't be a bartender any longer. And so I did a bunch of little odd jobs, nothing real significant. I had my first and only child when I was 23 years old. And interestingly enough, I was able to not drink during the pregnancy. I actually had enough, I guess at that time, willpower. You know, Bill Wilson says, or it says in the big book, you know, that we have a lot of willpower, but it's not a matter of willpower to stop drinking. But at the time, I wasn't under alcohol's incredible grasp yet. So I did stop drinking for the pregnancy. I had a very wonderful, healthy little child. However, the marriage was destructing. In fact, and I don't want to make any accusations here, but I have a feeling that the only reason that my husband married me, besides the fact he was drunk on the night he asked me, but was to have that child. And after that, it just seemed like there was really nothing left of the marriage. And we kept drifting further and further apart, although we kept partying very hard. We used to have people over. We would have these incredible parties, and booze would flow, and we went on vacations, and the booze would flow. Of all the while, I'm holding it together by being that person, and I actually marked the page in the big book because I think this, you know, I said one night at my home group, I said, I gave, because that's how I felt like I did. I was one of those alcoholics. Tried to hide my disease by being kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. I was always the class mom. I was always driving kids around in carpool. I was the ultimate East Cobb mother with a minivan. But what those poor parents of those kids didn't know is that I would go home and drink myself to oblivion every single night. Feels like I'm leaving something out, but I think you're pretty much getting the gist of it. I eventually looked outside the marriage for some sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Companionship. But I was thinking more along the lines, looking for something to make myself feel better, looking for something that I was always looking for to fill up that hole, to justify me, to say that I was worth it, to build that self-esteem. And it always is a horrible circle because you do something that you know is not right, no matter how much you think it's right at the time, and you drink even more because of it, and that leads you to do it again, and you drink even more because of it, and that leads you to do it again, and it was an ugly, ugly circle. I absolutely despised myself. Eventually, I decided I would be much happier without that man in my life. And so I asked him for a divorce. And we agreed upon that. And I was to get Corey in the settlement, the custody, whatever you call it. And the same week my dad died, The week before that, my grandmother died. The week after that, the dog died. And about 2 weeks later, the house was hit by a tornado. And I kid you not, I mean, that is all literally a sequence of events. So what does a good alcoholic do under those circumstances? You start drinking even more heavily, right? And I had a reason to, by golly. I was given my ticket. And I no longer had that guy around to watch me. I had, and just to describe, and I was never a very clever alcoholic, so I hope I'm not giving anybody ideas. My best ideas came from other people. Like, I remember hearing my next-door neighbors talking about this poor lady that was admitted in North Fulton with, like, a 4.0 blood alcohol level, and her husband had no idea she was drinking. And the way she hid that was to keep filling up the bottle with other bottles before he came home. So I started doing that. That was a great idea, you know? So I had really started, and I'm going to back up again, from about sometime around 16 or 17, I had started lying and started keeping secrets from myself. Well, no, not myself at that time. From my parents, from my friends. Eventually, throughout my marriage, my husband, obviously, all the friends that I had, all the friends were my son's parents, and none of them knew that I drank, or not as heavily as what I did, and I was just all about secrets and all about keeping it all hid. So then, anyway, it got really, really bad, and it got bad quick. My family was very active in trying to get me to stop drinking, and one of the methods that they decided to use was to make sure that I got a DUI. My mom and my brother showed up at my house one day and said that they were there to do something. I don't know, I got really pissed off that they were there. And they called the police, and I said, well, I'll show you, I'm leaving. So I left, and pardon me for stealing this from someone, but I really think it was profiling. Because I think the police was pulling over everybody at 1 o'clock that afternoon that happened to be drunk. That was running from their mama. I mean, I really think that was just not right of them. So after arguing with Cobb County Police that I was not drunk, they hauled my little butt off to jail. And I forget, I blew something really high. I mean, every time I say it, people go, and I think, well, maybe I don't have that right. But I mean, it was close to a 4. And I wasn't drunk. So if that gives you any idea, I mean, I felt like I wasn't drunk. I felt like I was functioning. But by this time, I was getting up in the morning, having a drink just to get going. I was sleeping for maybe 3 hours at a time before I'd wake up and had to have another drink. I was in really bad shape. I had really reached that point that they talk about where alcohol was controlling me. And as much as I didn't like to say it, as much as I would not have admitted it at that time, alcohol was the love of my life, even more so than my son. So anyway, the deal was they would let me out of jail. My mother and my brother would bail me out of jail or have someone bail me out if I agreed to go to treatment. And I'm going to be brief because my grand sponsor says I'm supposed to be to AA by this time, so I'm going to speed up a little bit. But so they let me drink all weekend, and I was really tickled about that. And by the time I got to treatment, which was, I don't remember the name of the program now, but it was not good. Apparently, when I was going in DTs, my blood pressure either went sky high or sky low, I don't know which. I started having hallucinations like crazy. And if you really want to think you're crazy, I mean, if you ever consider your sanity, you can think about me, because I really thought that Santa Claus from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and one of those little elves was sitting there talking to me while I was in that detox. I truly thought that they were there. I saw them. I heard them. And anyway, I didn't stay in that treatment very long because they ended up having to ship me off to Kennestone because the blood pressure thing or whatever was going on with me. And Kennestone would not keep me, so they sent me to that lovely facility, Georgia Mental Health Institute. Yay! Talk about a place you want to get out of fast. I, of course, did not belong there. You know? I was not crazy. I was not like any of those other people. And unfortunately, that set up a whole series of me being different from other people. I went in that summer alone to that detox. I went up to one in Gainesville. I was in Northside for a while. All these things were things my family was fixing up for me. Bless their hearts, they were trying so hard. But what they didn't get at the time is that I had to be willing to do it. And I had no willingness. I had nothing. And then they pulled their trump card. They said, "We're taking away your son." So I agreed to happily go into long-term treatment. And I went to MAR. And there, I learned all the really good basics of AA. I mean, it's a wonderful program. I ended up being there for 4 months. However, I got sober for my son. I would tell everybody that. If you ask me why I was getting sober, I'd say it's for my son. I'm getting my son back. My son and I are going to be at home. For those of you who don't know, that's a very bad reason to get sober. If anybody in this room is sitting here thinking today they're going to get sober because of somebody else, just lose it. You will drink again. You got to get sober for yourself. And I'm sitting here living proof of it. And I truly believe that within the depths of all of my being. So, as you can imagine, I drank again. Oh. And I had a very slender purse by this point. I promise that. And this next year and a half of drinking was probably the worst drinking I ever had. Now, the drinking before, believe I was drinking completely by myself. I had very few friends. The friends that I had were people who were at least as bad off as I was. And so you can imagine, you know, the shining examples of citizenship those people were. This time around, I had no friends because I chose to hide my drinking from everybody. As far as my family knew, I was still sober. As far as the people at work knew, I was sober. I was lying to everyone. I was going to AA meetings and picking up chips. Now, how sick is that? And I'm very sorry. I'm here to make a living amends for that, lying in AA meetings. Because I couldn't deal with the fact that I was not sober. And I knew that drinking was not giving me what I wanted. It had lost all, everything. It just wasn't doing at all for me what I needed it to do. And I describe it this time around as that this time I lost my soul. It was just gone. And when I came back into AA, I literally came back in crawling. And I like to tell people about that first meeting I went to because something tragic had happened. And I knew I was going to drink if I didn't get to an AA meeting. And that day I chose not to drink. And I went to that AA meeting. It was over 8111. It was a women's group, and it was around 11 o'clock in the morning. I just left work and said, "Got to go someplace, see ya." And got there and started crying and telling all about this horrible, horrible, horrible thing that had happened to me. And they listened to me for a short while, and then they finally told me to be quiet and listen. And afterwards, women came up to me, and nobody said, "Hey, it's going to be okay." Nobody said, "This problem's going to fix itself." Nobody said, "Life's about to be happy." But what they did say is, if you don't drink and you come back tomorrow, there is a solution. And for the first time, I mean, y'all, I'm telling you, after 4 months, I didn't know that. I was away for 4 months, and I couldn't figure that simple little thing. Don't drink and come back tomorrow. And finally, I had a chance. I had people expecting me to show back up, you know? And I had a commitment, and I wanted to be that commitment. And most of all, I didn't want to be me anymore. I said at a meeting the other day that, you know, my life had become perfectly miserable. You know, and when they told me I needed to change, I didn't want to change. But at the same time, you know, I knew I had to. I knew I had no choice. You know, it says in the big book that we're going to either end up in jail, an institution, or dead. Well, I'd been to jail. I'd been to institution. You know, I knew I only had one choice. And I don't think I was very, very far. I didn't tell y'all, going back again to that bad summer, the culmination of that summer right before they told me they were taking away my son was when I'd had two, not one, but two seizures at the ballpark. I also left out a lot of stuff. I was having such bad hallucinations at the time, and most of them auditory hallucinations. Anybody ever have those? I would hear the radio playing in my house, and I was convinced it was somebody, and I used to call the cops out to my house all the time and have them look for that man that keeps playing the radio so loud. So the only reason I go back and mention that, because I want to paint, if nothing else, if you haven't gotten that far in your alcoholism, you will. You will. If you feel the need to go out and tell, to write more of your story, you will get there. Don't aspire to that. So I came back in, and this time I didn't know everything. I think that was the major difference. When I went to Mar, I knew everything, especially about God. I knew God. I was raised in a Christian home. I had a grandfather who was a preacher, by golly. I knew all about God. Y'all don't need to tell me anything about God. This time around, my first temporary sponsor told me, she said, all I want you to do in the morning is get up and ask God to help you stay sober today. And all I want you to do at night is to tell him thank you for keeping you sober. Those simple instructions began what has been an incredible spiritual path for me. It led me to believe in a different God than I grew up with. Not that that God was so bad. He wasn't. He was a very loving God. I grew up with a loving God. But to know him on a different matter, a different plane, different manner is what I try to say, to actually want God's will done in my life, not Sue's will. I no longer wanted to run the show. I was willing to take suggestions. I did a 90 and 90. I did service work. I was at my home group whenever the doors were open. I was doing whatever I could. I got a sponsor. Oh, what an idea, huh? I read the big book, and I worked the steps. You know, I didn't think I was going to cry, but I think about my life then, and I just think about, after I worked the steps. And, you know, I'm not up here to preach. I'm just up here to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But if there's any of you out there that are putting off working those steps, don't. It changed my life. It talks about in the big book having a psychic change. You know, that and hanging around the good people that I hang around with, I mean, it's just been a life-altering situation. Had you asked me what would be my ideal life in sobriety, I would have told you that it would have been having Corey back in my life. And da-da-da-da-da, well, I'm here to tell you, I never, never, ever got custody back. And he grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina. And it's turned out to be one of the best things that's ever happened to me. Now, you may sit there and think that I'm a terrible mother for saying that, but I think that God's got a purpose for it. Corey's writing his own story right now and trying to do the drug and alcohol thing. And I have the most awesome relationship with him, and I'm able to talk to him and share my experience, strength, and hope with him. And I don't know that I would have been in a position to do that had I been the one all those years telling him to pick up his socks You know, I see mothers that do that, and I'm in awe of you. But I had to get myself sober first, and I don't know that I could have in trying to raise a teenager. In sobriety, it hasn't all been easy, but it sure has been fun. I had a great job, one that most people, you know, probably would have thought, wow, she's somebody. And I got laid off from that, you know, immediately lost that she's somebody thing. But it just turned out to be the greatest thing. And the weirdest thing is when I got laid off, I kept telling everybody, this is going to be good. Some door is going to open. And by golly, the doors of Pike Family Nursery opened. And I found this dream job that I'm still at and I love, and it's completely different. I used to be in an office environment and always in a suit and all this, you know, briefcase the whole bit, and now I'm in boots and khakis and mud all over myself all the time. That same year that I was saying that doors were going to be opening, I started dating somebody that I had known for quite a while. We ran in the same circles. I had this group of friends, he had this group of friends, but the group of friends intersected, and one day we just kind of bumped, slap into each other and said, wow, this feels pretty good. And he's been around ever since. It's Stan, I think most of you know. Stan, and we are, as the rumor has it, we are engaged. We just still haven't set a wedding date, but that's going to come. My biggest problems today, you know, tend to be things like the garage is too full of stuff. You know? That is an amazing distance I have come. When I entered this program, I was broke, both spiritually and financially. I'm still rather broke, but I'm very happy about it. I don't know how that works. It's just that everything I would have told you, the things I would have ticked off, success, wealth, standing in the community, things I thought all mattered, I have found out matter not one cent. Not to me, anyway. What matters to me now are friends, family, the kids, the grandkid, you know? Stan, of course. And I have today a wonderful group of sponsees that keep me very much on my toes and make me work very hard to try to be the person they expect me to be. And that's what's important in my life today. You know, I look at it and I think that sobriety is number one. My relationship with God is right up there with that. Sometimes it switches around. I couldn't have one without the other. And everything else falls behind that. And I really feel that if I keep my eye on that, then I have a chance to stay in sober another 24 hours. I'm going to let y'all out early. And I appreciate y'all listening. And I hope somebody got something out of it, because I did. Thanks.
Thank you, Sue. I picked Sue many months ago, and she's been trying to get out of it ever since.